listener-sponsored radio continues to be that listener-sponsored. That means you donate and show your love financially to the institution that's been providing you a perspective of the world since 1960. WBAI New York, WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind coming up right now.
Hey everybody, welcome back. This is Kev O'Donoghue back with you with a positive mind, bringing you some ideas, concepts, and guests, try and help you lead a more positively minded life. And back in the studio today, as promised, Dr. Kent Robertshaw. Kent, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be here.
You know, say it one
always
more time.
Always a pleasure.
And Nassima Diane Deemer is here also.
Hey everybody, happy to be
listen,
back.
Listen, we had an exciting conversation yesterday about opioid addiction in America. And we wanted to take your calls yesterday, and we're going to get to your calls very quickly today. Do you know somebody who's struggling with opioid addiction? How did it happen? Did you yourself take opiates at one point? We want to hear your story. We have a lot of information. We had a lot yesterday. Kent, why are Americans, why, you know, we are prescribed 99% of the hydrocortisone or Vicodin in the world is being prescribed in this country. 81% of Percocet. OxyContin is being prescribed in this country. This is a problem. Did doctors start this problem?
Yeah, absolutely. The doctors, pharmaceutical companies, they are, you know, completely responsible or accountable for the shift that's happened in the last 20, 30 years. As you're implying, every other country in the world continues on the same, you know, use of opiates for mainly acute injury or chronic cancer cases. You know, they, Russia, China, India, Africa, all the other countries, European countries, they continue on the same rate that the United States was and the world was in the 1980s. So we're the only country that has had this epidemic and explosion of opiate prescriptions that have left Heath Ledger, Michael Jackson, Prince, countless other people dead. Yeah.
And just to give you again some facts, over 115 people per day are dying from opioid addiction or misuse of opioids. In January of 1980, the New England Journal of Medicine published an article titled, quote, "Addiction is rare in patients treated with narcotics." That's 1980. In 1995, OxyContin, a long-acting version of oxycodone, which slowly releases the drug over 12 hours, is introduced and aggressively marketed as a safer pain pill by the manufacturer Purdue Pharma. And in 2007, the federal government sued Purdue Pharma. And three executives won a judgment of $635 million. Three executives plead guilty to criminal misdemeanor charges and later sentenced to probation. And then now, what's the good news? In 2016, the CDC publishes guidelines for prescribing opioids for patients with chronic pain. It all started with pain, right?
Yes. Yeah. Opiate prescriptions are only for pain, you know, or mostly. Some opiates, as people know, are like Imodium, which is a form of opiate, which is for diarrhea, right? Constipate right. You.
Hold on. Say that again.
Huh.
Yeah, Imodium is
a form of opiate. So, again, opiates have – they have a cough suppressant, as you know, people may know it's in cough syrup. right? And that's a very small percentage of opiates or and cough suppressant. And opiates also can cause constipation. So, again, it's a treatment of diarrhea. And Imodium is mm-hmm. a sort of watered-down version of opiate, whatever. But for thousands of years, opiates have had two, you know, main uses. One, appropriate use for pain, acute pain, surgical pain, trauma pain, mm-hmm. and then end-of-life, often cancer pain treatment. It's only been in the last 20-some years in the United States and America was the idea that 30, 40-year-olds with back and necks and shoulders and the like, it's safe to prescribe daily opiates for chronic daily pain.
Yeah. Because, you know, it wouldn't happen. People wouldn't who don't have pain wouldn't be taking it if it didn't feel good. Right? I mean, it does something different, let's say, than other drugs do.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, why would your son or your daughter or somebody who has no pain enjoy an opiate?
Well, I would think they had some sort of pain, some sort of psychic pain.
Oh, okay.
You know, psychological pain, mm-hmm. trauma pain. Mm-hmm. You know, teenage years are really tough to get through, and it's a big lure. You know, it's like, why did, yeah.
Is this a particular? I'm trying to get at. Is this right. a particular kind of high, Kent, that is particularly seductive?
Oh, it's a high, all right. I mean, it's again, as I mentioned yesterday, it's, you know, for the last 150 years, the two big drugs of abuse in the world. Is cocaine and opiates. And those two chemicals, we find out biologically, neuroanatomically, are the chemicals that hit the pleasure center of the brain. Mm. There's a part of our brain that is not necessarily involved with pain control and the like, but it's a part of the brain that if chemicals hit that part of the brain, it goes, yummy, delicious, yeah. I want to do that again. And all substances of abuse, right? There are millions of chemicals in this world, but there's only about 50 chemicals that humans and animals misuse, and they all hit that same area of the brain, and cocaine and opiates hit it stronger and more powerfully than any other chemical on this planet, and hence are incredibly euphoric, and in that way have memories that are formed in the brain of euphoria, joy, peace, nirvana, whatever, that make them highly desirable for the brain to want to do again and again and again.
212-757-5555. We want your calls today. Dr. Kent Robinshaw will take your questions, any kind, about this epidemic and about the type of high it is. I mean – go ahead. You want to say something? 212.
Yeah, well,
let me just say the number again. 212-757-5555. David, if you called yesterday, we want to hear from you. We're sorry we didn't get you. We had a few others. What was the name? Lena wanted to call.
Right.
There were a few others. So anyway, 212-757-5555.
And it seems like with such a high, that when that wears off, it's a pretty low.
Yeah, yeah.
And pretty painful low. And if you don't have the capacity to sort of hang with that, you'll start seeking the high again, right? That's the hardest part is to, you know, bear through the pain. You know, hopefully it's not as bad as it was when you, you know, took
talk,
it.
But, talk about, that's yeah. a good point, because, Ken, talk about the length of the high or the relief. Let's call it relief, because I do want to talk about the pain aspect, which was the original intention of the medication in the first place, and then the sociological and psychological reasons for it. But talk about the length of the effectiveness of the opiate and the different types, like Vicodin will last.
Yeah, I think as you mentioned that different opiates have different levels of action. As I said yesterday, the opiates are they're the strongest chemicals to cause that part of the brain to light up. And say, yummy, that's euphoric, I want to do that again, opiates.
Mm-hmm.
And they vary in strength, as I said yesterday, again, like alcohol, right? Beer and vodka are ones less has less alcohol than the other. But if you take enough beers, you're going to get very drunk, right? And similarly, that's where narcotics and people somewhat think that some of the milder narcotics that aren't as strong aren't as dangerous. It's just not true. You just take more of them, and you'll eventually just unlock that part of the brain that gets euphoric.
Right.
So the strength isn't as much as important as aspects of it is whether it's short acting or long acting. Those are two very important parts of how opiates are different. And as you implied, there was an idea in the 90s that by having long acting opiates, that they would be less addicting or less problematic. Mm. And, you know, that was the big con or the big lie, you know, that obviously turned out to be not true. I, as I told the Columbia students, we talked about the lecture I gave last week, you know, early 2000s, we had, George Bush saying there's weapons of mass destruction, and we have, you know, what you just mentioned, you know, the American Medical Association and lots of doctors saying that opiates aren't that dangerous and it's safely to prescribe people without running into problems. And I think history will look at both of those as the big lie, one by the government, one by the medical association and a pharmaceutical company, that turned out to be not be true. But once something like that's going on, it's very hard for anybody, the medical profession, human beings in general, when a lot of people are buying on to something, you know, it's very hard for doctors to push back and go against the majority. And I think as I was saying,
is that changing? I mean, is that why doctors over prescribe in the first place? Let's say out the number 212-757-5555. Because, again, doctors started this. Did doctors overprescribe? They got the red flag or the checkered flag to keep going.
Oh, yeah.
Right? With prescribing it, because one study said that it's not addictive. Now, that one study also dealt with inpatient people, and it was only like 38 people.
Right. And again, as doctors, you got to understand, particularly when a pharmaceutical company comes out with a study, a pharmaceutical company who says this medication is the best medication for X, the best thing since sliced bread. That happens all the time in medicine. So I've been around 30-some years, and most doctors, again, we see one study coming out, a small number of patients sponsored by a drug company promoting its drug to say our medication's better for high blood pressure or for diabetes or for depression or anything for that matter. That should make most doctors be very wary of, like, okay, I need to see this replicated. I need to see an institution like Harvard or Columbia,
right,
or some
multiple studies.
Yeah, multiple studies. But most importantly, people who are neutral. You know, somebody who doesn't have skin in the game, right? You know,
Kent, let me take this call. Anthony is
not here.
Okay,
yet.
He's
Hold
not
on.
Here. Okay.
Oh, okay.
There he is.
Hold
okay. on a second. Here we go.
See how we work here. All right. Hello.
Hello.
Anthony, is that you?
Yeah, it's me.
Tell me about your experience.
My experience is as in February 1968, I had my first, I snorted heroin. And that began a lifetime of opiate abuse. Had I known what I was getting into at 13, I know I wouldn't have done it. And so I shot dope and cooked speedballs for years, and then I got on a methadone program for 25 years, kicked it three different times, the worst thing in the world. Mm. So now I'm in NA. I've been in NA almost 24 years. And now we're seeing people coming in, and in the last 6 months, we had like about 15 kids in Westchester County die from overdoses who came to the rooms to get help. Two of them hung themselves. Right. Two young kids, 21 right. years old.
So, Anthony, talk to the 13-year-old in you. What would you say, having gone through this journey, to the 13-year-old that's thinking about taking their parents or there's somebody in their family's pills? What would you say?
I would tell them if I could get through it, which is hard to do, I would tell them exactly what they're getting into. I would tell them that it's a dream, that you could put your whole life in a pill bottle. Your whole life will be set by how many pills you can get on a day-to-day basis. Your life will be just counting pills, or you'll be counting your money in tens, meaning a $10 bag of heroin.
Right.
So you count your money in tens.
Where are you? Yeah, that's beautifully said. I hope people are listening to that. Where are you at with your treatment now?
Well, I've been clean like almost 24 years.
Okay.
In the last 24 years, I've had two relapses, but I go to meetings every day. And the thing is with going to meetings and stuff, if you stop going, you lose your connection because mm-hmm. there's some power in the rooms. And don't ask me what it is because I don't know. But I know when I separated myself in 2002, I had a relapse.
Right.
And I had a relapse in 93 after being in there for 90 days. So I went out for 18 months and I've been back ever since. And I know that the disease talks to me in my own voice, and I listen to it. And that's the problem. That's why I have to make meetings, because I have a disease, and it talks to me.
Anthony,
and it tells me I don't have a disease.
Anthony, thank you so much for sharing your story.
That's a great
thank
story.
You.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Thank you. I hope people listen, because it's a dream.
I hope so,
it's
too.
It's a bad dream. It's a nightmare.
Kent, what do you have to say to that?
Well, I love what he just said, and I think it's very important that a lot of people between 15, 20 some years old, they feel – this is probably true with lots of substances of abuse, maybe pot, marijuana, other things as well, alcohol. But certainly there's an idea that, oh, my gosh, here in a pill is nirvana, God, peace, you know. And it turns out to be a nightmare.
Let's see how popular the rooms are. We have another caller. Steven's on the air. Hello, Steven.
Good afternoon. How
Good
are
afternoon.
You?
Good. How are you?
Thank you for devoting time to this very important topic.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to talk about a situation that arises when that you have a patient who is going to have surgery, and they do not want opioids. They say they want medical marijuana instead, which, while it will not deal with the pain at the same level, mm-hmm. when you're done with it, you're not addicted.
Yes.
Okay.
So let's hear what the psychiatrist says about that, because I'm curious. It's a good question.
Yeah, I think these days, you know, the fact that it's legal in lots of states and there's medical marijuana in New York and the like, I think a lot of people. A lot of doctors would respect the patient's wishes to deal with the stress and pain of their surgery any way they see fit. So I would hope a lot of doctors are not pushing back if you're saying I want an alternative to opioids.
Right. So wait, and I want to go further with this. And I want to tell you that, unfortunately, I was in a position, this exact position, okay, and they started me post-op on a fentanyl drip, okay? And what does fentanyl do? It depresses brainstem function, and it constipates you, okay? And the important things post-op, okay, are oxygenation and nutrition, okay? So they started me on a fentanyl drip,
okay?
And then about 24 days later, and then I had opioids, and I said,
"What one?
What
kind did you take?"
They gave me Oxy and Percocet.
Wow.
Okay. They gave me both. I had my choice.
Okay.
And I think the Oxy was I didn't. Well, they were effective for the pain management, but it was everything else that I hated. Tell us what that was,
because, you know, people need to know the downsides, even when they get the high or the good part of it. But what are the downsides, even as you're enjoying the drug?
The downside was the OCS, the opioid constipation syndrome.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the psychological part for me was I didn't like the way it made me feel. I didn't like it.
Some people complain about it being like it makes them a zombie.
Yes, it was. Look, this was bad. Plus, I know from my own experience in the clinical world, okay, that I knew what was happening, and so I was reducing after the second week, I reduced it to where I was gritting my teeth during the day. I was only taking it in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 23 days, I tried to stop, and I got the runny nose. I'll tell you, it was frightening. And I'll tell you what the my knight in shining armor was, somebody who worked in the marijuana industry, who I don't know.
We don't want any names.
And they provided me with a kit, and I used, and it was not necessarily medical marijuana, but it was a cannabis-based product, and I used it as an exit drug.
Right.
Yeah.
And more,
I used it. Want everyone to hear. It was, I did not use it as a gateway drug. I used it as an exit drug, and it helped me to forget the withdrawal aspect from the opioids. I took them every single day for like 24 days straight.
Wow.
That's enough right there.
I'm going to take you off, Steve, and have Dr. Kent respond to all this. Thank you for calling us. I just want to know, where are you at now? Are you drug-free, marijuana-free?
Occasionally I will use a cannabis-based product in the evening if I have any discomfort or any digestive.
And all of this started because of pain for you.
I have abdominal surgery that was very nasty.
Okay, yeah, that's a vulnerable area. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take you off and have Dr. Kent respond, okay? Thanks for calling, Stephen.
Okay. Bye-bye. You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, 212-757-5555. We're talking about opioid addiction, opiates. An addiction, erstwhile addiction, it happens to people when they don't even want it to happen. Stephen was clearly disciplined and didn't like it, and the negative side effects scared him, and that was reason enough for him to not stay with it. But a lot of people don't have those experiences. What do you want to say to Stephen brought up?
I think, you know, when you brought up the good news in the last few years is there's been a shift in the medical profession and thinking, and shows like this would have been unheard of 10 years ago, talking about the misuse of opiates. One of the recommendations that is now coming out in the last year or so is to not give more than a 5-day supply of opiates. So what he's describing at post-surgery is day 21, 22 of being on opiates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very common. And again, over the last 20-some years, many people, not surgical, you know, people coming in with all sorts of complaints to their doctor or to a pain doctor, would walk out of the office with a 30-day supply of opiates, right?
Wow.
And what we know about opiates is they are phenomenally addicting. That over time, there's two aspects of addiction that come into play. One is tolerance and withdrawal. Tolerance means that you need more and more to get the same effect. And withdrawal, which can happen within 30 days, and I think he was describing 21 days, can happen with opiates, which is if you don't have it, you start getting uncomfortable. And that doesn't mean you're feeling the pain that you walked into the doctor's office 22 days ago with, right? That means you're feeling maybe that pain or not, but now you're starting to feel opiate withdrawal.
Right.
You're starting to feel the dark side, because the truth is there's no free lunch, right? If anything is going to give you a magical cocaine, opiate, magical euphoria, Mother Nature doesn't think kindly to that. There's no free lunch, and there's going to be 12 hours later a withdrawal phenomenon. And so what's changed recently is an idea that you only can get a 5-day prescription. You need to come back to the doctor. And again, for many decades, people would walk out with a 30-day supply. Mm-hmm. And then by that time, they have a small monkey, maybe a chimpanzee. It's not an ape at that point.
Mm. Right.
But it's not nothing, right? They have a little monkey on their back, and if they're going to try to come off 30 days of using opiates, they're going to feel really uncomfortable. They're going to feel worse for days on end.
Yeah.
So they're going to go back to their doctor and get another prescription. And again, over the last 20 years, you talk about $600 million Purdue. That's nothing compared to how much Purdue made with OxyContin. They're billionaires have come out.
Yeah.
And again, the doctor every month is, you know, gets you hooked, right? So every month you got to come back to the doctor's office and get a prescription for 30 seconds of seeing the doctor, charging the insurance company, Medicaid, a couple of $100s, which is coming out of taxpayers' dollars. So the doctors are making off good. The pharmaceutical companies are making off good. Everyone's getting paid every month because the person has to come back because they're physically addicted.
212-757-5555. How about somebody out there who's had a good result with opioids and yet got off them themselves, were willing to tolerate the withdrawal symptoms? And I hear the withdrawal symptoms are very difficult, very difficult, as opposed to, you know, even other drugs.
Much
more difficult to manage and to get off of.
Oh, yeah. I think the best description would be, imagine the worst flu you ever had. So again, as it makes sense in life, opiates deal with euphoria, pain relief, right? So the flip side of that, of the withdrawal, is depression. But as opposed to whole body pain relief, imagine that malaise when you have a flu, your whole body hurts.
Yeah.
Times 10 for days on end, unremitting. That's opiate withdrawal. Days of chronic pain.
We have June on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, June.
I want to thank you for your material you're covering. I have a question for your guest and for you, too.
Sure.
I have a young relative who overdosed on fentanyl. He'll be 21 this year. This happened this winter. I understand that he got it through the mail. It comes through the mail,
sure.
And evidently it comes with a certificate that says it's pure and unadulterated, so it's not bad for you, that kind of thing. I would like your guest to please comment on this fentanyl epidemic, because I'm very, very worried. We sent him to a rehab center immediately. He's back now. He has a job. But I know once you've been on fentanyl, and my doctor told me this, it's very, very hard to not go back on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could comment on fentanyl, what it is, where it came from, and what you think we can do about it, and how are people getting it in the mail?
Thanks, June. Sure. Well, thanks for calling.
And I'll get off the line so I can listen.
Sure, sure, sure. We have other people. But sure, Ken, so fentanyl has been around for a long time.
Many decades and decades.
And wasn't it used on animals at one point?
It's a very strong narcotic. It's, again, if you go to Sloan Kettering, you go to a cancer institute, it's, you know, with very severe pain, cancer pain, it is, you know, a very effective opiate.
It would be the one that they would give you.
Yeah, fentanyl. It's very strong, often in a patch to put it on the skin. It's a very strong opiate. But it's, as I said, it's all opiates are strong if you take enough of it. But it tends to be, you know, very, very high concentration. I don't think it's any worse than OxyContin or whatever. It's just a very pure.
If it's the right dose. I mean, if you're getting a patch, then, you know, there are not overdoses with patches, right?
Well, no, you could put enough patches and die easily.
But supposedly one patch. I mean, if you have one patch.
Well.
You know, I mean, it has to, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
but again, once you've built up tolerance, like if, so what is true is if we went to a chronic pain place with cancer patients, many of them are taking doses of narcotics because they build up tolerance to it that would kill me and Kevin and everyone in this room. Meaning they're on doses because they've been on it for months or years. They, as I said before, they built up tolerance, so they need higher and higher doses for their appropriate treatment of their cancer pain. They're on extremely high doses. They're not misusing it. They're not having problems. They're not getting high from it. They're just need it for their cancer pain. But, you know, they need a lot of fentanyl that, again, would be something that would kill a lot of people.
Right.
So, you know, this whole thing about how easy it's been the last 20 years to get narcotics, I mean, you're talking about one aspect of it, the mail order. My understanding is, even up until recently, you can get some doctor that you don't even see on the phone somewhere to write a prescription for a narcotic, right? The doctor doesn't examine you. You just subjectively say, I've got this pain and whatever. And then they can get it mail order. You know, that was going on.
Right.
My understanding down in the South, I mean, I'm not making any of this up. You guys, people in the audience probably heard this on the news, and Florida in particular, people would just go in busloads of you know, from Oklahoma and neighboring states, go up to a clinic, never have been there before, go in there, and then they bring their friends and cousins. Maybe somebody already had chronic pain and got on it, but then you just get a whole group of people on a bus, go across state lines, show up, pay them X amount of money, and they would say, you know, yes, I have pain, and yes, nothing else helps other than opiates. And then everyone would walk out of that facility with, you know, as I said, 90 pills, 1 month supply of OxyContin, and get on the bus and go back to the various states. So these pain clinics.
So the clinics will still give you a full 30-day load.
That's right.
In general.
That's the, yeah. I think even though the CDC, even though the recommendation has been out for a year or so, which again gives doctors a little bit of coverage to now say, I'm not going to be cool. I'm not going to do what many other doctors do, or even most importantly, I'm not going to do what you want, patient, right? I'm going to follow the recommendation of CDC. And it's very helpful that I think there's been this recommendation, because again, if you have a person, a patient demanding narcotics because they're in pain, we have to empathize that some of these doctors, again, are in a position of, I want to help people, and they're telling me they're in pain, and they say opiates help. And I'm, again, a lot of these doctors aren't just money hungry, you know, people wanting to turn people into addicts. They feel they're not able to help people. And the person saying, well, opiates help. I got my cousin's opiate. I got some fentanyl. That helped me. Why can't you help me? And they've sort of succumbed to the pressure of patients demanding narcotics over the last 20 years. And this will give some kind of ability for doctors to say, no, it's not the recommendation to give either, you know, any amount of opiates for your syndrome, or certainly limit, if I am going to give you opiates, to the not the kind of levels that people used to give.
Yeah, and just to comment lastly before we go to break for June, that, you know, it's very hard drug to monitor by the Postal Service. I mean, you could mail it to your friends. I mean, it's not like it lets off an odor or anything. It would get caught up in screening through the mail. So not only will doctors send you a prescription through the mail, people can send it illegally through the mail. And I wonder if her son was a victim of that.
Right.
You're listening to The Positive Mind on WBAI at 99.5. And we're going to take our musical break. Just a moment. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
That's Weird Fishes. Umphrey's McGee. 2011. You're listening to The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 in New York City. In the studio, Dr. Kent Robertshaw and many callers. And we have a few online. And Nassima Diane Deemer is here. So,
well, one question I had, you know, it's like the doctors are giving the 5 days of opiates, you know, if they're following the protocol. Do they also give referrals for physical therapy, massage therapy, acupuncture? Is that coming through?
I don't think that's coming through at all. I think it's right now just a what the recommendation is as it relates to opiate of what not to do. I don't, you know, sadly, I think doctors, like a lot of human beings, are not motivated to, you know, give recommendation of the right thing to do. Because here I am, an addiction psychiatrist, and I'll go back to June's question about what can she do with her loved one who had fentanyl, who seems to be clean. And Anthony has one of the big answers that doesn't help me out in my career and my paying my rent, and doesn't help me out as a doctor. But it's the right thing to recommend to people, which is NA, right?
Yeah.
I recommend to people all the time, go to Narcotics Anonymous,
yeah.
right? And lots of
free.
Doctors,
it is
and
free.
It's free, and lots of doctors, consciously or unconsciously, do not make referrals to, you know, agencies that's
yeah.
going to take their clients away from
so
them.
So other people right. are the solution. We'll talk more about that. We have Sean on the line. Hello.
Sean. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm excellent. It's actually Shaw.
And
I'm a holistic doctor, and you would think that people who come to me would understand what that means, because generally they're a little bit off the grid, and they understand that we don't just have medication. But the first thing out of their mouths is always the same.
Do you have your radio on? Shaw, is your radio on?
No, I'm on a cell because I'm walking around.
Okay.
But
can you stay in one place? Can you stay in one place?
Yes, is that better?
That's much better. Go ahead.
Okay.
So you're a holistic doctor and you don't just do meditation.
Medication.
Go ahead.
Right. We don't do medication.
Right.
I'm an herbalist also. So
okay.
We do things of that nature. So before we do anything, we want to find out exactly what the issue might be. But the first thing out of everyone's mouth is always the same. Doc, I have this problem, that problem, the other problem. What do you have for me?
Okay.
And they always want a solution, quote unquote. They don't want to understand the underlying thing. And we in America have come to a place, and I think we've been there for a while now, is that people cannot differentiate between pain, discomfort, and a little bit of irritation.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody wants to feel numb. You know, it's like you drive a fancy car,
yeah.
and it's numb. You can't really feel the road. They don't want to feel any bumps, any anything. So
right.
before they even get to the opioids, before they even get to any of the herbs or anything else, they want to be numbed out
mm-hmm.
because they don't understand what it means to live.
So how do you make a living in this environment? You know, you're a... tell us, how do you persuade people to not go that route?
Well, to be honest, because what I have works. So... It is difficult, and it means that I have to talk to a lot more people, and I have to spend a lot more time giving out information, so I've
yep.
gone along that route.
Right.
You know, because you have to explain to people, what does it mean to live a full life? What does it mean to be living? What does it mean to step into a ditch and sprain your ankle?
Right.
Do you understand the difference between, as I said, irritation, discomfort, and pain?
Mm.
They're not the same, so... I have to spend a lot of time just educating people on what it means to live.
Yeah.
Right. And that pain doesn't have to be the end game, you know? It's that pain is a part of life, and you can find a way to move through it sometimes when you're supported by someone who can say, yeah, that pain is there. It's not the end of the world. We're going to keep working with it. And there's a lot else that's also potentially good.
Is that a big part of your practice, Shaw, is the talking to the person?
Definitely. And again, everything is not pain. I know a lot of people think, oh, I'm in pain. They love to say that.
Right.
And I'm not going to be cruel. Like a lot of men will say they're in pain. You have to dig into them, but they feel that they're in pain. They won't say it, but they feel that they're in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not in pain. Some people are just in the level of irritation. Others are in discomfort.
Right.
But the pain level that we think, even going into the process of being in pain, and I have to say, for all of my clients, I work with their allopathic doctors, and I work with them, and they're coming from a place, and I can say it happened to me. When I was a teenager, I was doing weightlifting. I was a bodybuilder.
Okay.
And I got hit in the face with one of the weights.
Right.
And that caused me to have stitches. Mm. Now, at the time, I was, you know, healthy individual. I'm, you know, still pretty healthy, but I was healthy. And yet I was given all this pain medication and all this antibiotics and everything else. And it made me very, very sick. And when I went back to the doctor and I said to him, you know, it's not working for me. His first response was, well, you know, you're going to be in a lot of pain. So there's no way I can take you off of A, B, and C.
Okay.
And there's just no way you can do it any other way because this is the protocol. This is what you do. He didn't say protocol, but this is what you do.
Right.
It turned out that I went back to my own family doctor who had been working, you know, 30 years plus. He took me off of everything because he knew my history. He said, you know, I know that you're healthy. And he also knew that I was taking vitamin C, which is...
And he also knew that you could tolerate pain to some degree, right?
Exactly.
I mean, a lot of these, a lot of doctors do not have the time to gauge whether the client A, B, or C is willing to live with the pain, is willing to withstand the discomfort. And you're the type of person he could tell off the bat that you're going to be able to handle it. Is that part of the, you know, the remedy for you?
Part of it was that, but he also said, let's see what happens.
Yes.
You know, don't just assume that everybody wants to be numb just because the majority of people do.
Right.
Great.
He worked with me and said, and it turned out I didn't need anything because, and that's another thing working with my own clients, to understand that sometimes when you have infections, they are painful because the body is trying to heal itself.
Right.
If you have enough of the natural substances, such as the vitamin C and the other anti-inflammatories, the naturally based ones, if you take them, it will cut those issues and you won't feel the pain.
Sure, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for calling us. Keep calling us. You're adding great insight for us. So thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, so Kent, is the medical community responding too quickly to pain and not taking the time to know the patient?
Well, and I think, you know, the last caller gives me an analogous to psychiatry as well and the center here that we work at in terms of psychotherapy. People are in psychic pain. People are in physical pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people want a pill. They want to not do the work that I would say, not that I'm this hard, tough guy, but, you know, I would think a lot of people, let's get on physical pain, a lot of evidence would suggest that, what again, you were talking about before, massage therapy, physical therapy, you know, you, the patient, right? This is not a cavity and you're going to a dentist and the dentist magically gets rid of the cavity, right? Or appendicitis. Most chronic pains, the syndromes we talked about yesterday, neck, back, whatever, these are mechanical problems that have occurred in joints and limbs and the like. They're not necessarily the bones per se. Everyone talks about the discs and whatever, but it's the connective tissue and the muscle. And the good news is that a lot of that is fixable, but it takes, you know, physical therapy, doing stretching, doing exercises and the like. And I feel a lot of empathy for people in chronic pain because, again, when you're in pain, you don't want to move, right? That's what happens when you have acute pain. You have a broken bone. There's a part of you wants to be very passive.
Sure.
Right.
But one of the keys to helping chronic pain is you have to get a little bit of pain to work joints and elbows and backs and move them and the like. Not be passive, and God help us not be passive, sit on the couch and then pop a painkiller, which is going to have you nod out. You actually have to slowly, like they do in physical therapy, get movement and strength back. Because the key about a lot of these injuries is the doctors are often wrong when they're saying it's the joint or whatever. Many studies would suggest it's the connective tissue and the muscle. And what we know about muscle is like concrete. If you don't stir concrete, it hardens, right? Uh-huh. And muscles are identically the same way, your neck, your right. back, and all the above. If you don't move them, if you don't keep them moving, they will start locking up. And whatever pain syndrome you have
right.
is going to get a lot worse.
Right. They lose elasticity. They lose water, you know, like nourishment. They lose the ability to put the blood through. Yeah. And when tissues stop moving, they start dying.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's pretty incredible. But when I do touch people who have like chronic things that they haven't moved, I mean, all kinds of different symptoms come from that. But to go in and feel, it's almost like you're breaking through concrete. I mean, it really is pretty remarkable how the body will start to just sort of plaque around a certain area
right.
or congestion will move in. And
right.
just there's nothing, you know, healthy going on there. And there's so many healing factors that can come through.
But when does chronic pain become too much? I mean, for me, chronic pain is a nag, right? It's nagging. And like how long? I mean, people who suffer from arthritis, right? I mean, that's a lifelong, once you start having arthritis, it only gets worse, right? So it's like a nagging pain. Do people need, are there techniques, are there methods, are there things people need to do? I mean, we should be mining these people suffering from arthritis on how they handle their pain without opiates,
right?
I mean, what can you say about nagging chronic pain? I think there's research that the brain of people that suffer from chronic pain is different.
Yeah, and
from people who don't.
Yeah, I think certainly the depression and anxiety, that loop that can go in the head, that feeling of helplessness and hopelessness that I'm, you know, my pain is bad. It was bad yesterday. It's going to be bad all day today, and it's not going
right.
to get any better. That mindset is in a lot of people that get narcotics, right? So that depressive, hopeless mindset is key to turn around, because that will then fuel the loop to amplify the pain. That will make the pain worse. We know depression and anxiety makes the pain worse.
Yeah. So if a nagging is a kind of depression, let's call it what it is. So if you're having that and that's making you long for an opiate or longing for some kind of pain medication, it's better to do these things like exercise or talk to somebody or be part of a group. That's one of the things Anthony said at the beginning.
Or all of the above.
N.A., you know, it was saved him. When he stopped going, he relapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And so he realized he doesn't know what the alchemy of N.A. was for him. But it was, you know, it's a cure. So,
yes.
So this nag can be handled by just sharing with people in the vicinity, in your area, in your home. Talking. So we also have Gloria on the line. Hello.
Hi there. How are you today?
Good, Gloria. How are you?
Hi, Gloria.
I'm doing fine. You are talking to an issue that affects my life every day.
Go ahead.
In 2005, a drunk driver ran a red light and rear-ended my car, which turned out to be a three-car collision.
Mm-hmm.
And he left me with injuries to my spine, to my neck, and to my lumbar.
Right.
And, you know, I was only 40 then. I got trapped within pain clinics.
Mm.
And I thought they were going to cure me and help me get better, back on my feet, back into my career, and I was over-medicated.
Okay.
What were they giving you?
I think everything.
Yeah.
I had pain patches, I had opiates, I had muscle relaxers. I had multiple injuries. I was very injured, and they kind of disregarded the things I needed, which was surgery.
Right.
Yes, we had Darla call yesterday. Did you listen yesterday?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so how long did you live before you had the surgery?
She didn't.
I had surgery finally in August 2015.
Wow.
That's
10 years?
No.
They let me go 10 years, and when I finally went to a doctor, an orthopedic surgeon who said he would do the surgery, I sobbed. I felt so betrayed by the medical field.
Right.
And
right.
I realized it was a medical industry.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Did you take yourself off the pain meds?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I always knew that I didn't want to get caught up in pain medications, and I had those conversations with my doctors. And I went through I went through a lot with the pain medications. I kind of resented them and appreciated them at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It felt to me like, and I still take them, but I'll let you know why. It felt to me like it was a ball and chain.
Right.
Mm. You know, very limiting on my lifestyle, affecting me physically.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
then after I had back surgery, the surgeon was clear he wouldn't prescribe it for a certain amount of time. And I went to physical therapy for 10 months because, you know, various parts of my spine were affected by going that long without help.
Sure. Wow. Yeah.
And I got to a point where I was feeling great. I was working out. I was doing physical therapy. And then last December, I had a slip and fall on the bus.
Okay. Yeah.
And what happened?
Agitated, I'm in pain again.
Oh, gosh. But you don't need surgery, right? I mean, do you feel like you need to have that looked at in surgery-wise?
Well, I went back to a spine doctor, New York Presbyterian Columbia, and they're helping me. And what I do like is he has given me opiates, but he doesn't give me. You know, I went back to physical therapy. I'm back to exercise. And I'm
Fantastic.
Back to doing the things to try to help myself get forward,
right.
go forward.
So before we go, just tell us, what would you have advised a younger Gloria to do once this accident happened?
Oh, I would definitely, you know, everything you mentioned is good. I would definitely have gone to an orthopedic surgeon and assisted before. They started telling me I was too young for back surgery. That's what they were telling me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That I was too young for back surgery. Mm-hmm. It would leave me, you know, in more pain. And I was on a walker. I was really mm-hmm. bad. And I had a career. Now I'm disabled. Okay. I just feel like they let me suffer needlessly.
Right, right.
You know, the other side was I'd like to do medical marijuana, but, you know, in New York City, it's hard to get. It's very mm-hmm. expensive.
Mm. Yeah.
And then I find that my peer group, a lot of people just don't understand what chronic pain is.
Do you have a support group?
I have friends, not really a support group.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So. Well, it sounds like you're managing it, Gloria. It sounds like things are looking up. You do believe in the exercise component?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, stay well and give us a call again in the future. Thank you for calling.
No problem. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, exercise, I think, is like one of the main, if you can get to it, if you can get moving again, you can start feeling human again on some level.
And right? it's a real art form, you know, to be honest. It's a real papa bear, mama bear, right, with injury, right? You know, you see it with athletes all the time. Underdoing it, as we said, can cause muscles to lock up. And that's where most people with pills are, right? They're just not doing anything. They're in that hopeless place. The only thing that helps my pain is popping a pill. And that's hopeless, right? They've
right.
given up on
There's
exercise
no hope.
Therapy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the end of the road, right? It's like the only thing that helps my pain is a narcotic, right? That's the end mm-hmm. of the game, right? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, and they often just lie around on disability or whatever because
right.
they're regressed in this place of pain, and the only thing that helps is the opiates, which kind of narcotizes me and makes me passive and makes mm-hmm. me, you know, sort of you know, comfortable,
yeah.
independent, totally. As opposed to, again, you don't want to overdo it, right? I mean, obviously, injuries, you've got to listen to your body about overdoing it. And so that's why, again, physical therapy, exercise is the kind of thing. It's a real art form to sort of get the right balance, which is not over-resting an injury to the point where your things are locking up and getting worse. The pain is getting worse because you're not using it anymore, and it's now causing problems. As you said before, blood flow, muscle strength, everything starts mm-hmm. going out the window. But the other mm-hmm. side is you don't want to overdo it, right, and re-injure yourself.
Okay, we only have a few minutes. I did want to close out with some facts. 43,000 Americans die each year from opioid addiction and abuse. The major states, obviously you mentioned yesterday, West Virginia. West Virginia has got the worst epidemic. It's 52 people per 100,000. Then Ohio, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. Mm-hmm. The good news, Kent, is they're finding, like, when they open clinics that are dispensing methadone and buprenorphine, that it's reducing the overdose deaths in those areas where they're working. So the country is, I mean, fentanyl's become a bad word, right? I mean, everybody who says that word now is like clouded with some dark feeling because it has wreaked such havoc in the world. So, I mean, one of the benefits of getting this out there is that we're realizing we have to take control of this. ourselves, and people are reacting to the power of fentanyl. I think fentanyl abuse has gone down in the last year, the one opioid that has gone down in abuse. Do you know anything about these clinics? Do we have any here in New York?
Dr. Robertshaw prescribes his buprenorphine, right? Buprenorphine is a medication that is what is truly a different kind of narcotic, where you can't overdo it, and it causes very little sensation of being high. So buprenorphine is a once-a-day medication that, if you're on opiates for pain, I would recommend everybody to get shifted over to buprenorphine, which is a much more stable, less yummy, but more stable way to deal with chronic pain.
Yeah. You've been listening to The Positive Mind with Kev O'Donoghue and guest Dr. Kent Robertshaw, psychiatrist affiliated with the Columbia University addiction specialist. Thanks for listening, Nasima Diane Deemer.
Thank you for having me. We'll be back
next week. We'll be back on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday we're going to be doing our fun drive featuring Harville Hendrix. And we had him on last week, and we have lots of goodies for you when we do that fun drive. So look forward to talking next week. Be well. Thank you.